Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Supreme Court legalized state-based sports gambling. You ready to place your bets on the Sox or the Celts? Or could gambling compromise the integrity of the game? Also today, Boston University has a new women's basketball head coach. Marissa Mosley is a BU alum who's also spent the last 9 years as assistant coach with the most dominant team in college sports, UConn.
For the last 9 years, I had a front row seat in one of the best classes a coach could ever dream of.
And it's commencement season. Astronaut Stephanie Wilson spoke at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts.
Life and career goals are a marathon, not a sprint. Continually learn and try to be steadfast in your craft, and be steadfast and unmovable in your dreams.
We'll hear other highlights that take us to the stars. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, so let's talk about that big Supreme Court ruling this week, the one that struck down a 1992 federal law blocking most states from legalizing sports betting. The court considered the question in purely constitutional terms, but the 6-3 decision instantly transformed the issue into purely economic terms for states and for sports teams and for sports leagues. By one estimate from the American Gaming Association, until yesterday, at least $150 billion per year were wagered illegally on sports in the United States. So is this an incredible opportunity to engage a new generation of fans? Imagine all that betting going on instantaneously over smartphones. Or, to that same point, is this an opportunity to engage a new generation of gambling addicts? Could this be a risk to the integrity of the game or of any game? Or could it be a lifeline to sports teams and sports leagues? Or, I mean, option F, all of the above, because this is a really complicated story. But obviously, Massachusetts has some of the biggest names in sports, with the Sox, the Patriots, the Celtics, the Bruins. And do you think the state should open up the doors to sports betting here? So call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now is WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Meghna.
Also with us is Andrew Brandt. He is an NFL business analyst for ESPN. He's a columnist for Sports Illustrated, and he's director of the Murad Center for Sports Law at Villanova Law School. Andrew Brandt, welcome to you.
Good to be with you guys.
Okay, so Shira, let me just start with you here. When you heard about the Supreme Court's decision, I mean, what was your first reaction? Because this is overturning a law that's been on the books for a generation.
Yeah, since 1992. Not surprised. I think everybody anticipated that this was the way the Supreme Court was going to rule. And not only that, leagues and daily fantasy operations like DraftKings had been preparing for this eventuality. So it was, everybody saw this coming. Now the big question is, how do they divvy up all the money that's going to be coming out of the legalization of sports betting? And that's the great unknown at this point. There are some things that people are predicting.
Well, we can get into the nitty-gritty for a second here, but I just want to go straight to this integrity question, right?
Because,
I mean, from what I understand, one of the reasons why, I mean, there have been scandals in generations past about betting on
sports. Every generation, there's been a scandal.
Isn't that still an issue?
Yeah, I mean, you can go from the 1919 Black Sox up to the referee scandal, Tim Donaghy, I believe his name was, with the NBA, who was betting on games. So, yes, and in every statement from every major professional league that was released yesterday after the ruling, they all said that the top priority was protecting the integrity of the game. That's going to be incredibly difficult to do, I think, unless you have some sort of federal framework in place, because otherwise you have every individual state regulating their sports betting differently. And that is just a massive, massive headache for the leagues trying to protect the integrity of the game. But, you know, this is going to be a core issue, and this is going to trail this ruling
So I just before we go any further, I need to correct something I said a little earlier. It was right, but I said it wrong. It was a 6-3 decision, not a 7-2 decision from the high court. Point being that either way, it overturned the law. So, Andrew Brandt, let me get your take here. Were you surprised or not? And then I just want to hear you follow up with what Shira was saying about the integrity question.
Well, I've been following this a long time and in the courts, and there were 6 years of the NFL and NBA and the leagues winning this case, where New Jersey kept coming back. And a year and a half ago, the Solicitor General advised the Supreme Court not to kick this case. And lo and behold, a year ago, May, they took it. And as soon as they took it, I knew, and legal scholars knew, and people in the business kind of knew, they weren't just going to let it stand. They weren't going to take a case to let it stand. So, yeah, they were going to do something. And it just seems to me that the leagues are surprised here. And they are surprised that all of a sudden the paradigm has shifted where they're going to be told terms from the states rather than them dictating terms, which is their usual default negotiating position. Because they won this case for so many years, somehow they thought, well, we'll just keep winning. And it seems to me they're a little bit behind the eight ball now because I don't even know what their framework is. Sure, they're going to try to get legislation in Congress. They've been trying that for years. But with everything going on in this world, fast-tracking sports gambling legislation in the U.S. Congress, that's a crime.
Tricky. Yeah. Shira, jump in here. I mean,
yeah, I don't know if I would say behind the eight ball. That wasn't my impression. I think that they I think they saw it coming. I think they, are now kind of trying to figure out how to react and also keep the trust of their fans. I mean, I think they're trying to balance two things because, believe me, they're also looking at how they're going to profit from this. I mean, already the NBA and the NFL are asking for what effectively is a 1% kickback, what they're calling an integrity fee for sort of the added, kind of burden they face to protect the integrity of the game.
So pay us to be sure that we don't compromise our own profession.
I mean, that they're calling, I guess, an integrity fee. I mean, that's sort of their thinking. So I don't know. I mean, I don't share the opinion that they were caught behind the eight ball. I think they may have some catching up to do in terms of how they can capitalize on it, whether it's through indirectly through, something like an integrity fee or something else.
Yeah. Okay. So Andrew Brandt, I mean, I think Shira brings up something really interesting. We're 24 hours after this decision, so still in the early hours, let alone days. But what are some of the ways that we could possibly see, short of Congress passing a law, but, on a state-by-state basis, team-by-team basis? Let me put it this way, Andrew. Could people, go to a betting kiosk at Fenway Park sometime soon and, bet on the outcome of the third inning of a Red Sox game?
Yeah, I think a lot to unpack here. First of all, on the integrity issue, I've been around the NFL a long time. Integrity's always been the watchword. It's been the watchword towards gambling. I remember even trying to have a fantasy football draft when I was president of the Packers, and the league kind of didn't want to hear about it. And here we are. But I will say this. I mean, I think they lost some of their moral high ground here when they placed the franchise, the NHL as well, in the Mecca of gambling.
Yeah, you have the Oakland Raiders moving to Las Vegas, and you have the Golden Knights in Las Vegas now as well.
The NHL expansion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think an $800 million stadium subsidy changes your view of integrity pretty quick. So here we are, and they're trying to get integrity fees, which, as you pointed out, is kind of an interesting, ironic twist when they've been fighting integrity about gambling, but now it's like, get the fees. And if I'm a state, I'm saying, why in the world would I pay that?
Yeah, especially since Las Vegas, they weren't paying, didn't have Las Vegas or Nevada paying as a state paying an integrity fee.
So here's where we are. New Jersey's ready to go. Monmouth Park has been retrofitted for a sportsbook, Nevada-style sportsbook, and $1 million has gone into it. They say they're opening by May 28th, 2 weeks from the date of the decision. They'll be ready to take bets on the NBA Finals.
Wow.
Other states that are fast-tracking are around in the mid-Atlantic, including Delaware and West Virginia and Pennsylvania and even down in Mississippi. They're probably not going to be ready anytime soon, but perhaps by the NFL season. And then there's a bunch of states in the on-deck circle that may be ready to go by 2019. So it's not going to happen right away. And even in 10 years, we're not going to have all the states. I mean, Utah is not going to have sports camps.
Ever, probably.
Never.
Yeah.
So, but I would estimate half the states are going to be involved in somehow. It just depends how far they are along legislatively. Are they in the Senate? Are they in committees? Are they in the House? And New Jersey is farthest along by far.
Well, they're the ones who brought the suit, right? So,
right,
but Shira, let me just ask you here. I mean, to that point, I think I heard Governor Baker yesterday say that this being sports betting is something that Massachusetts ought to look at. What more do we know about what could happen?
Yeah,
here?
I mean, at this point, Massachusetts lawmakers haven't acted on a proposal to study sports betting. So I think we're unsure at this point if they'll take up the issue before this year's session ends. So it's a bit of a wait and see mode for Massachusetts. And until lawmakers act, we don't know what form legalized betting will take. However, and Andrew, I don't know if you have the same thinking, but it seems to me that the states that are first in on this will have a larger say, perhaps, in what the regulations for this betting looks like. So it might be, I would think, from a state perspective, from Massachusetts' perspective, advantageous to kind of get in there and get in there early, at least in terms of looking at the issue and trying to figure out what regulations they might want to put in place, because I think those who are in there early and debating this issue early will shape
I'm also just going to go out there,
go out on
a limb and say, at the very least, Massachusetts lawmakers are going to find it very, very difficult to say no to the potential revenue stream that
yes.
this represents.
Yes. Yes.
Andrew Brandt.
Well, I think you're right, and I think, as we mentioned this, Nevada is the standard and will continue to be the standard. I remember when Roger Goodell gave a press conference after moving the Raiders to Vegas, he literally praised all the regulations around Nevada. And these are the same regulations he was fighting for 6 years in New Jersey, but whatever. So he's going to praise Nevada. That means Nevada's the standard. And I think absolutely all these states are looking at Nevada. Yeah. It's worked there, and it'll work wherever else.
Well, we are talking about the Supreme Court's ruling this week that has paved the way to legalized sports betting in the states of the United States, including possibly here in Massachusetts, if Massachusetts chooses to go that way. And I'm speaking with Shira Springer. She's WBUR sports and society reporter. And with Andrew Brandt, he's an NFL business analyst for ESPN and a columnist for Sports Illustrated. He's also at he's the director of the Murad Center at Villanova University. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And I'm wondering if you're a sports fan and love the idea of being able to place bets on your favorite teams, or if you're worried about what effect that's going to have on sports or even gambling addiction. Again, we're at 800-423-8255. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Let's get some calls in here. I want to start with Dave, who is calling from Dedham. You're on the air, Dave.
How you guys doing? You know, if you go to the Premier League in England, which is as big as or bigger than the NFL, you can bet right in the stadiums. I've done it. You can bet. You can place bets on different aspects of the game. You just can't get your winnings that day. You have to go to a betting parlor to cash in. But it's the same concept. You know, that you could do it at Fenway Park just as easily. In fact, it might save baseball because now you have all these innings that you can bet on. It might bring more interest to baseball.
Dave, thank you so much for your call. I was actually just wondering the same thing this morning, Shira, that there are places in this world that allow betting on the highest profile sport in the world, and the sky has not yet fallen.
Yes, you're correct. And I think looking at the Premier League in England and how they do it in England is perhaps a good model to see at least how logistically it might work here. So I think the caller brings up a really, really good point with that.
Okay. But what about also it might, he was talking about it being a lifeline.
Oh, yes, yes.
As well.
The
possibly.
Lifeline part, yes.
Yeah.
So I completely agree. And not only do I agree, but Mark Cuban, owner of the Dallas Mavericks, agrees because he was asked about the legalization of sports betting yesterday. And he talked about first, he said it was going to double the value of any franchise in the major professional sports leagues here. And he also said, you know what? You got all that downtime in baseball.
I was going to say something to do.
Something to do.
Because
it may make, he was like, it may make baseball interesting again.
Oh, dear. Gambling, making baseball interesting again. Okay, let's go to Bruce, who's calling from Fitchburg. You're on the air, Bruce.
Hi. Yeah. I just hope that sufficient attention is paid to people who do have gambling problems.
Yeah.
My ex-wife had a severe problem, and she wasn't the only victim because my kids suffered. After we had gotten divorced, she actually lost her rent money a number of times because she couldn't make it from the bank to the landlord without stopping at a casino. And I don't know. I'd like to hear some discussion about what the current measures that are being taken to help people, or, you know, in terms of the new casino that's opening up and the place in Plainfield and whatever.
Yeah.
And that's all I have to say.
Bruce, actually, I very much appreciate your call. Thank you for calling in, because, I remember during the hours of debate on Beacon Hill about whether or not we should legalize casino gambling in Massachusetts. And this was one of the main issues. The worry there was that if we brought casinos into Massachusetts, that it would make it easier for people who had were at risk of gambling addiction to form a full-blown gambling addiction. Imagine how much easier that would be with sports betting, especially if we were talking about earlier. Like, what if you could just do it off of your cell phone? I think it's a very important question. Andrew Brandt, what's your thought about that?
Well, this is a morality issue that's very important, and I think some of the roadmap here will come from something you're very familiar with in Massachusetts, which is the fantasy roadmap. When DraftKings and FanDuel were being opposed by state legislatures 3 years ago, one of the big issues was potential compulsive gambling, where they're doing fantasy every night with basketball and hockey and baseball. And one of the ways that it was sort of resolved in Massachusetts and New York, ultimately after litigation, was controls in place, where there'd be geofencing. You couldn't bet if you move out of state. There'd be controls about minors. You can't punch in your app unless you enter your birth date or who you are. And if your birth date's not a certain number, you can't do it. And, of course, money set aside for problem gambling, which is going to be part of all these bills.
Yeah,
I think that's important. The other point to make is the goal of all this is to reduce control consumption, not to increase consumption. It's to control it, because right now it's being done illegally.
Right. That $150 billion a year we were talking about. Right.
This is going to be done legally. So I don't know if the bookie in the back of the barbershop is ever going to go away. But this is now being brought into the light.
Yeah.
There's not going to be a darkness about this anymore.
Well, Shira Springer, I take Andrew's point about this, but I'm wondering with the, you know, perhaps there's something of a natural, I know there's a dispute about this, but perhaps there's something of a natural cap when things are, you know, under the table, when they're on the black market with gambling. Let's talk about that specifically. I'm wondering, and I think a lot of people might have a concern, that if, you know, with legalization, sure, it possibly can be better controlled, like Andrew was saying, but the volume of it, if its availability, might just skyrocket. Every teams, leagues, states. I mean, it could become
you're going to be bombarded
ubiquitous.
With it.
I mean, sports are ubiquitous in our society.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if you expose more people to something, there's a better chance that more people are going to like it, enjoy doing it, and as a result, they're likely going to be more people who become addicted to gambling. And it's going to be a very tough problem to solve in the wake of the legalization of sports betting. And I'm particularly curious to see how leagues are going to get involved and teams are going to get involved. I mean, you know, I think right now of drinking and the drink responsibly commercials that you see associated with sports events sometimes, or even at sports events. And I'm wondering if there's going to be similar advertising or campaigns centered around sort of a gamble responsibly type of campaign. I don't even know if that's feasible, but I think we're going to start seeing some socially conscious messaging about gambling as soon as this comes into play, because like you said, we're going to be bombarded by it. It's going to be everywhere. And simply put, more people are going to be doing it.
Well, let me just bring in one more voice here briefly, if I may. That's Layla Mintis. She is deputy president at U.S. Sport Radar. Layla Mintis, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, if I understand correctly, and help me out here, Sport Radar helps capture and deliver live play-by-play data to companies, to media companies, tech companies, things like that?
Yes, sure. So we are the league partner. We are having contracts with most of the major leagues in the U.S., for example, the NFL, NBA, NHL, MLB, and NASCAR. So we are the league partner. We are the official data partner of most of these leagues, which means we get their data, we sell their data for media proposals. And as you mentioned, some of our media customers are Facebook, Google,
right.
Yahoo. But we also engage in the sports betting business. So we have sports betting data that we receive from the leagues where this data is available, and we are able to kind of sell this data outside the U.S.
Outside the U.S. Okay, I was just about to ask, who is buying this?
Yeah. So far, only outside the U.S.
And how, let me just to get a sense here, that American Sports League betting data that you've been selling outside the U.S., how lucrative has it been so far?
It has not been too bad. Otherwise, we would probably not be so strong in that business. So we are the global leader when it comes to sports betting data. We cover the majority of the global betting market worldwide, where betting is legal. That's a big point here. And we are having a lot of different services. We do integrity monitoring, for example. So we take care that no match fixing, scandals around that happen in sports. So we monitor on behalf of the sport leagues their games, and we cross-check with the international betting markets if someone somewhere around the globe is potentially coming to the U.S. to try to influence the outcome of these games. So that's very essential. And it's important to do that on a global level, because even though betting has not been legalized outside from Nevada so far, people outside the U.S. are betting on U.S. sports.
Right.
So one of the things that I'm curious about is, and I think that will happen in the wake of this Supreme Court ruling, is that you're going to see a lot of other businesses spring up to support legalized sports betting. So I'm wondering, are you going to try to perhaps partner with leagues or teams on the integrity factor, to protect the integrity factor? Do you see not just a business in not just providing betting data, but also in securing the integrity of the game that everybody's been talking about? Is that a business opportunity for a company like yours?
Actually, that's a big part of our business strategically. It's very important to safeguard sports, but it's not a business opportunity. So we do that more or less for self-cost. So it's a non-profit business for us. We do that, for example, for the NBA. We cover all their games. We monitor if there are some potential irregularities. We do that for MLS soccer, for the NHL. So we do that already for most of the big leagues in the U.S.
But have you ever found any irregularities?
Not for the U.S. sports so far. Not for the ones that I mentioned. But we have found cases, for example, for FIFA. So we have the World Cup coming up.
Surprise, surprise. Yes, I was going to say, I'm shocked that there's irregularities in FIFA.
Yeah, but football or soccer is a most popular sport around the globe, so that's not a surprise that we have a lot of match-fixing cases in soccer. And also, on a global level, almost every sport has been involved in match-fixing, so there's no sport immune against that threat.
Okay, Leila, hold on for a second. What you just said is quite remarkable, and I want to get Shira and Andrew's take on this. Leila Mintis just said that on a global level, in every league that they've been tracking and gathering data on, there has been match-fixing that they have detected. So it makes me wonder, would that not make it inevitable here, Andrew Brand?
Well, she can answer better than I can, but I would think a lot of that match fixing is lower level games where there are not a lot of eyes, not a lot of attention on those spreads, which still could happen here, but not with an NFL game, not with an NBA game, maybe with a college game that's a low level division game. But I would think there are just so many eyes on these big time sports, where she's referring to lower-level matches in soccer and tennis.
Okay. Well, Shira, I'm glad that Andrew brought up college level, even though he was talking about lower divisions, but one of the things people have already been talking about is NCAA players in Division
I. There's a BC gambling scandal at BC, so,
And the players don't get paid, so, yes.
Yeah.
I think there's room for concern.
Yeah, I think there's room for concern, and the question I have is then what happens once you discover, data that indicates there's been match fixing, or game fixing. This opens a whole other can of worms. Where do we what do you do once you realize that some of these games are not on the level.
Yeah. Leila Mintas, one last quick question for you. What's the scale of sports betting globally? I mean, how large is this business? We were talking about in the United States, underground so far, it's been $150 billion. Do you have a sense as to how much it is worldwide?
It certainly is huge. It's very difficult to estimate that, but it's multi-billion, if not trillion, dollars. It's a really, really huge market. And what you need to keep in mind that people really bet also for on sports because they love sports. And they want to engage deeper into the sport. And especially with the NFL, with TV ratings going down, that's a big opportunity to engage fans over a long game to keep watching the game. If people have only a stake of $10-$20 in the game, they watch differently. There are studies out there that they watch more games, they watch games for a longer time if they bet also small amounts on it. So I think we always have to look from an industry standpoint.
Yeah.
Fan engagement is huge. Sponsorships through betting operators is huge. Selling the betting rights, of course, within the U.S. is a huge business. So I think that would end up being a big most likely multi-billion industry.
It sounds like multi-billion at the very least, because everything that you said about additional watching time, additional viewing time,
at this point.
I just, I'm just hearing cash registers. Leila Mintas, deputy president at U.S. Sport Radar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Andrew Brandt, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up here, but NFL business analyst for ESPN. Andrew, thank you so very much.
Happy to be with you guys. Thanks.
And Shira Springer, WBR Sports and Society reporter. I imagine that there's a couple of more stories about this that you're going to be following up for
us. Yes, and I'll be checking in with you on your betting habits.
I only bet on one thing, okay? That is that this is going to continue to be an issue here in Massachusetts.
The safest bet there is. Safest bet there is.
Shira, ththanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When up-and-coming Boston art curator Olivia Ives Flores conceived the theme for her latest exhibition, Menagerie, she knew almost immediately that she wanted to include her father's work. She says she knew Enrique Flores Galbis, a classic portraitist for more than 30 years, would have something vital to add to the collection. But there was a hurdle. Flores Galbis had stopped painting after he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2015. WBUR arts reporter Maria Garcia has the story.
I'm at Amalgam Gallery, a big, bright, rectangular space on Newbury Street. The crowd is lively and diverse, sipping cocktails in front of paintings. They're here for Menagerie, the latest exhibition by up-and-coming Boston art curator Olivia Ives Flores.
You know, whenever I curate an exhibition, it really starts with a feeling.
The theme of this show is flora, fauna, and wildness. There's one painting I keep going back to throughout the night. It's called A Tropical Childhood, and it's filled with bright colors. Deep, rich blues, vibrant greens, yellows, and oranges. And the colors form an abstract shape. You can see remnants of a raft in an ocean, tropical tree leaves, a menacing tiger, the silhouette of a child, and boots and limbs peeking out. Here's Olivia again, the show's curator.
To be able to show that work for the first time ever that's up here now in the Menagerie exhibition, it's really an honor.
The painting was created by Olivia's father, artist Enrique Flores Galbis. For more than 30 years, he painted exquisitely rendered classical portraits of people. But in 2015, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. He stopped painting portraits soon after.
And I just was not up to doing these detailed things that I used to do, like putting a highlight on a child's eye or putting a just the detail that you needed to do and the firmness of your hand.
But Olivia knew her father still had something to say as an artist. And she knew that because Olivia and her dad are like
peanut butter and jelly.
Olivia grew up in a very creative home. Her mom worked days as a graphic artist. Her dad, Enrique, painted at night and spent the day with his daughters.
He always reminds me that he talked to me as an adult, even when I was a baby, and would tell me about art and illuminate these great masterpieces, even when I was still in a diaper. And I actually took my first steps at the Metropolitan Museum.
There's a palpable, complete trust between Olivia and Enrique. Enrique took his daughter to a pool when she was almost 2 years old. He'd read that children have an innate ability to hold their breath underwater.
And I would throw Olivia in the water in a deep end, and then I'd jump in with her, and then we'd be underwater. And I would watch her, how she held her breath, because I could see that she trusted me. There was not one iota of fear in her.
That bond is still there. So when Olivia called her dad and asked him to take up the paintbrush again, to be part of her exhibition, it was his turn to take the plunge with her, to hold his breath and trust his daughter. Enrique returned to the studio, ready to paint through Parkinson's.
With Parkinson's, it's a lack of dopamine in your brain. Dopamine is sort of a key chemical in you enjoying the world and making you happy, giving you a reward. And I wanted to just increase the reasons for rewards.
Gone were the days of the beautiful but muted portraits. This time, Enrique sought something else when he painted. He sought to activate happiness in his brain through vivid color and intricate shapes.
When I'm out of the studio, I'm feeling so-so. When I'm in the studio, I'm flying high. I'm the best that I am all day. And that's the gift that art has. And I hope that feeling translates in the work.
Among the collection at Menagerie are luminous, abstract paintings with equestrian themes. Olivia thinks the subjects on horses in her dad's new style of work are symbols of his rebirth as an artist, despite Parkinson's.
Having something that is bigger than you or, you know, really could take you for a ride, but you saddle up and you tell it where to go. And I think that there's such a bravery in that.
Before Menagerie opened, Enrique came up from New York to help Olivia hang the artwork at the gallery. The activity turned out to be a silent, delicate dance between father and daughter, like their whole lives had led to this moment.
We did it without talking most of the time, and we were just in perfect syncopation and knew organically where each piece needed to live.
It was like this kind of wordless interaction that was really interesting.
Theirs is a relationship built on creativity and trust. That connection enabled Enrique to find a new artistic vision and a new purpose in his brushstrokes.
That story from WBUR arts reporter Maria Garcia. Well, it's that time of year.
To the class of 2018, congratulations to you. Are you ready? Yeah? Okay, I hope so, because lock in, the world's got a lot of problems, and we have been here waiting for you to come and help us solve them.
Well, that's Margot Lee Shetterly speaking at the commencement ceremonies at Worcester Polytechnic Institute this weekend. Shetterly is author of Hidden Figures, the marvelous book turned movie that told the story of brilliant African-American female mathematicians who worked at NASA during the earliest days of the American space program. Women such as Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson, who became NASA's first black female engineer in 1958. Now, black women have made considerable contributions to the American space program. Mae Jemison was the first African-American woman to travel to space aboard the space shuttle. She was an astronaut on Space Shuttle Endeavour in 1992. Fast forward to Stephanie Wilson. In 2006, she became the second African-American woman to travel to space. She was aboard the Space Shuttle Discovery. The Pittsfield native lent some words of wisdom to the graduating class at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts in North Adams on Sunday.
Even though I must contend that my generation has left for your generation some immense problems to solve, we know that you are up to the challenge. Find good mentors, especially those who have accomplished what you wish to accomplish. Persevere to the very end. Life and career goals are a marathon, not a sprint. Continually learn and try to be steadfast in your craft and be steadfast and unmovable in your dreams.
That's NASA astronaut Stephanie Wilson speaking this weekend. Over at Worcester Polytechnic, Margot Lee Shetterly told the story of Henry Reed, an engineer at the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, NASA's precursor. Reed graduated from Worcester Polytechnic in 1919, and he went on to hire black women at his laboratory.
Now, I'm not trying to paint Henry Reed as a civil rights activist. He certainly wasn't. His job was to manage aeronautical engineers, and he didn't sign up for social engineering. The first impact of his decision to hire these hidden figures at the laboratory was to supplement the brain power that America needed to win World War II and to best the Russians in the space race. It was a practical solution, and the importance of practical solutions was literally written into the NACA's founding charter. But I like to think that Reed also knew that this was the right thing to do, the fair thing to do, a decision that pushed the world that was toward what it should be, where equality is not just a mathematical concept, but the ethical equality of the Declaration of Independence, as in we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal.
Shetterly told the WPI grads that Reed's story is the perfect example of how scientists don't have to focus on just numbers and data. They can and should be humanitarians, too.
So often we see the sciences and the humanities cordon off for one another or placed into conflict as if they're natural enemies, facts versus feelings, left brain versus right brain. We speak of vocations that deal in analytics versus careers concerned with warm and fuzzy people issues, and we assume that the people who are good at one are by default unsuited for the other. But science and the humanities are both rooted in the same motivation, which is to measure and understand the natural world and to make the human world a better place. And though the lonely scientist is a stereotype that still prevails, the fact is most science and engineering, as you know here at WPI, is carried out in groups, and it requires clear communication with and understanding of others. Regardless of the path that you're setting out on, chances are you'll find yourself in a situation where your ability to connect with other people, to discover a shared sense of humanity, to see the people around you as more similar than different, and even to help them make the most of their talent, that will matter. Your career may depend on it. The mission of your group or your organization may depend on it. And most importantly, the future of your community, of our country, and of our world will depend on it.
That's Margot Lee Shetterly, author of Hidden Figures, speaking to the Worcester Polytechnic Institute class of 2018. We also heard from astronaut Stephanie Wilson, speaking at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. They both spoke at commencement exercises this weekend. And congratulations, as always, to the class of 2018. In the coming days and weeks, we'll hear more of these wise words from commencement ceremonies around Massachusetts. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The women's basketball program at the University of Connecticut has established itself over the last 20 years as one of the most dominant, if not the most dominant, college sports team of all time. And now, a piece of the UConn dynasty is taking the helm right here at Boston University. UConn assistant coach Marissa Mosley is the new head coach for Boston University's women's basketball team, and it's kind of a homecoming for her as well. She's a BU alumna and a former BU basketball standout as well. She helped the Terriers to the America East Championship back in 2003, and from there it was on to work as an assistant coach at the University of Minnesota and the University of Denver, and then 9 years at UConn, where she assisted the Huskies to a It almost defies belief, but I got to say it, a 331-14 record. And Marissa Mosley joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And welcome back to Boston University, I have to say. So first of all, how does it feel taking the helm as a head coach here at BU?
A little surreal. You know, being here as a student athlete and going through the recruiting process and going to class every day is one thing, but then now kind of trying to convince other young women to do the same. I feel honored that I've gotten the opportunity to do that, especially at my alma mater, because I feel like I know it so well. And at the same time, there's so much that's changed in just the few years I've been away. So I'm excited to kind of get to know all that BU offers even now.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your history as a player here at BU, and I'm definitely going to want to talk to you about the coaching skills that you're going to bring to the court here. So I mentioned that 2003 year in the America East Championship. You were team captain that year, leading BU in steals, blocks. And then you had to play UConn in the first round of the tournament. What was that like?
Yeah, so we actually just, at Tees Pub, we had our viewing party. So it was like, oh my God, we're in the tournament. And then it's like, oh, we're 16th seed and we're playing UConn. Like, woo, I think. So we went up to Gamble Pavilion, and I had worked camp there, and that's how I kind of got in with UConn in the working capacity after college. But so I had been there before and played pickup and everything, but definitely it's a different experience, especially when you get rocked by like 40 points. And I always tell people when I was coaching there, they're like, oh, you don't get it. I was like, oh, no, no, I get it very well. I understand, and I like being on the side better.
Okay, well, okay, I'm going to get back to sort of your experience as a player here for a second. But since you went straight to it, I mean, UConn, insanely dominant, right?
Yes.
I mean, not only is their win-loss record almost impossible to believe, true that it is, but like game by game, like they do frequently crush competition. So this gets us straight to like the endless UConn controversy, which is, are the UConn women too dominant for women's basketball?
Yeah, I despise that question. Not from you, just like the overall global question. Because I think it seems that question only comes up with UConn. Like, no one asks, is Tiger too dominant for golf, or are the Patriots too dominant for the NFL? Like, so for whatever reason, because I don't know if it's because it's the women's game or because it's just been going on for so long. If anything, I think it's helped grow the game, and it's raised the level of awareness and attention to women's sports, and it's helped try to raise the competition level.
Okay. So, I mean, I appreciate that you didn't say that you resented it coming from me. But I'll give you someone that you can be angry at. I want to play a little bit of tape from Boston curmudgeon Dan Shaughnessy. He has a very strong opinion about this. This is Shaughnessy in 2016, basically talking about UConn's championship run then.
Okay.
When you have every game, it's 50-19 in the second quarter, a sport that's trying to generate new fans. How is that good for the sport? Who's going to hang in there for four quarters when you're up 40 every game? This is not like UCLA or the Celtics or the Warriors. Every game is 40 points. What's the point?
What do you think?
Yeah, what's his point? No, just kidding.
You can say that.
No, I think it's not what's the point, because quite frankly, our attendance is actually, or UConn's now, I'm at BU. So UConn's attendance was up this year, the best that we've had in 10 years. So to say that people don't care, they're not tuned in, SNY was paying $1 million a year to televise our games, and our games were the highest rated, why we always played at 9 p.m. on ESPN on a weeknight, because we were the highest rated. So to say that people were tuning out, or that it just, they didn't care, we heard tremendous amount of support from our fans, and just other kind of casual watchers, like, we just love the way that you guys play and the way that you respect the game and how hard your kids compete. And that's why I get frustrated by it, because I think you don't realize the amount of work and the dedication and the blood, sweat, and tears that those young women are putting into it every
single
day.
It's because they make it look really easy.
They make it look easy, but it's not easy. What they're doing is not easy at all. And so for someone to kind of say, well, what's the point? It's like, they earned that, the right to be able to do that.
You know, you said something a little earlier, you just kind of slipped it in there, but I want to underscore it. I don't think anyone asks this question in the men's side of any sport.
Right.
And you know, dominant teams in men's sports are celebrated for their dominance.
Right.
So, I mean, do you think it has something to do that it's just it's
I think
it's
so, because even
team?
His example that he just gave, like, we're not talking about the Warriors or UCLA, you know, or I can't remember even the third
Celtics,
team. The Celtics. Yeah. So, because we're not them, because those are all men-dominated sports. Like, people don't care that they blow people out when they were dominant. It was like, that was just amazing and a beautiful thing to see. But now, because women's teams are doing it, no one wants to watch that, which I just categorically disagree with. And I think he should probably talk about something else.
So, let me ask you then, you were there for 9 years. Mm-hmm. What are some of the coaching lessons or strategies that you learned, you know, as assistant coach at UConn, and especially, I mean, you were working with Gino Auriemma, for all that time that you think you're going to bring to Boston University?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing is, no matter what your level is or the level of dominance of the program, the biggest thing I walked away with was our culture was so strong there. Our kids understood like who we were playing for, why we were playing, and the way that we were going to do it. And so every day, that's how we approached.
How was that communicated?
It was established right from the beginning. So there's people that came way before you who really kind of laid the groundwork. And we don't have a lot of banners in the sense of like individual accolades. So in our practice facility, there's national championship banners, which there are 11. There's 22 All-Americans. And then there's Olympic gold medalists only. Not even if you just participated, you had to win a gold medal. we have high standards. But and so that's one of the things that you're looking around every day and you're like, okay, all of these unbelievably great players came before me and other players who don't necessarily end up on that wall who gave their blood, sweat, and tears to this program. So we're going to make sure that there's a UConn way that we do it, and you're going to do that every day that you walk on this court.
Wow. Okay. And so I mean, do you think that exists here at BU, or is that something for the women's team that you're looking to build?
I think, you know, there's definitely a pride in the university. Any student athlete who comes here, I think you come in wanting to make sure that you represent your university in the best way possible. I hope to just highlight that and enrich it even more and make sure that we have a huge legacy that we leave behind, because as an alum, I have a huge sense of pride about that I went here, that I played for this great university. And I want to make sure that going forward, it's not just that, hey, I played here, but that we won and we kind of left something behind.
Yeah. So I read somewhere that you prefer man-on-man defense and not zone defense necessarily.
Well, it's funny. So my 4 years here, we played all zone, but it was a matchup zone. So I do like man-to-man. I think that I just like to get up and defend and deny and get in the passing lanes and block shots and, you know, kind of convert your defense into offense. So that's fun for me. But I think there's a time and place for zone as well.
Yeah. So take a step back with me for a second. And I'm wondering what your take is on women's basketball sort of as a whole, because obviously, I mean, UConn is a defining and a powerful force in terms of bringing fans to the game.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, do you see that same trend in at the professional level with the WNBA, or do they need sort of like a dominant UConn-like team to bring more people to the games?
I think in some ways between the LA Sparks and the Minnesota Lynx.
Yeah.
I was just going to call them Timberwolves, which is not what they are. And the Lynx, I think they have a little bit of that dominance. And those two teams generally, towards the end of the season, they're kind of battling the last few years.
Rivalry is always good.
Rivalry is always good. And I think Minnesota, by far, when I was there as a college coach, and even now just watching, they get a tremendous fan support. I think some of the cities that they chose to have teams in, although they're big markets for television and media, there's a lot going on in those cities. And so sometimes in the summer, to get people to draw the fans to come in and go inside when it's a beautiful day, that's probably some of what they contend with when it comes to fans and viewership. But I think it's continuing to grow. Anytime that you have a Final Four like we had the last couple of years, mm-hmm. Despite the fact that we came out on the wrong side of it, anyone else you asked, they thought it was amazing. We were, you know, it's still in the crowd. But I digress. But I think having that type of environment where people are just excited about the game, I think it's going to help it continue to grow. So I don't know if you necessarily need that one dominant team, but the rivalries definitely helps.
Okay. And then sort of, I'm kind of jumping back and forth between professional and college here. But, you know, on the college side of things, NCAA side of things, there's been a persistent question. And I think it gets bigger and bigger with every year as the money associated with NCAA athletics gets mm-hmm. bigger. I mean, just do you have a take on whether college athletes ought to get paid?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. We kind of keep this conversation going quite a bit in our office in UConn. And Coach Arima had a great take on this, and I kind of am adopting it on my own. So his was, that's fine, but if you're an employee, then you can also get fired. So if you don't come and perform and show up on time and do the job in which you we ask you to do, then you can lose your scholarship. So if you want to be paid and you want to be treated like an employee, then this is also what happens to employees. And I don't think that that's necessarily thought out on the student athlete side. It's more like, well, we're generating all this money, which I agree with, they are, and they should be some type of compensation. But then what happens if you don't perform?
That's a good question. Okay, well, I guess it's not one that we can necessarily answer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do you? We've got just got 30 seconds okay. left here. What would you say is your primary goal for your first season as head coach at BU?
Yeah, I just wanted us to establish a great culture in which we're going to work harder than everyone else. We're going to compete at everything that we do on and off the court. We're going to have a great time while we're doing it and try to win as many games as we possibly can with that in mind.
Sounds like a good set of goals here. Well, that's Marissa Mosley. She is the new head coach for women's basketball at Boston University. So she spent 9 years as assistant coach at UConn, and it's great to have you back here in Boston.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.